From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our foreign policy expert dissects next week's elections in the United Kingdom.
The two-party stability that we have in this country, the British no longer have, and that's not going to change. Even if there's a narrow majority in Parliament, my guess is it's not going to last very long for Boris Johnson. He's too erratic and too self-destructive.
Then a new study says the state financial package given to Foxconn may not have been needed to bring the Taiwan firm here.
We have no way of knowing. You know, Foxconn has an incentive to say that it was completely decisive. The policymakers who handed out the subsidy have an incentive to say it's completely decisive. But the best evidence is that these things are really only decisive in 2 to 25% of the time.
The host of an Arm and a Leg podcast joins us to talk about the impact of healthcare costs in the United States, and Beats Me answers your questions about recycling. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. In the last month of 2019, the world seems to be exploding. Populism is on the rise, and there are massive protests occurring in Iran, Iraq, Hong Kong, and Chile, to name just a few places. In all of those places, the governments in charge have been ruthless about cracking down on the dissent. Elsewhere, Britain's Brexit process chugs along, and Israel's prime minister has been indicted. Lake Effect contributor Art Sear joins us now to help make sense of all of what's going on, starting with the likely outcome of the UK general elections next week.
It's likely that the Conservative Party will have a narrow but workable majority, but that's not necessarily the case. The more important trend is long-term. The two dominant parties in the 20th century, Labour and the Conservatives, have steadily declined, starting in the 1960s, and third parties, including especially the Scottish National Party, which has replaced Labour in Scotland and is now the dominant party, and of course wants to be independent from the rest of the United Kingdom. The Liberal Democrats, a long-term interest of mine, the Welsh Nationalists, others less well-established, they pop up and go down like Nigel Farage's changing constellation of parties. It's a very interesting time, and it means that the two-party stability that we have in this country, the British no longer have, and that's not going to change. Even if there's a narrow majority in Parliament, my guess is it's not going to last very long for Boris Johnson. He's too erratic and too self-destructive, in my biased opinion.
How do you think Corbyn is faring in all of this? He's been under attack from his own party.
Yes. Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader, is a dedicated left socialist. Again, in strange ways, there is a mirror of events in this country, in Britain, that's very different from the rest of Europe. Objectively, the Labour Party should be doing quite well, but he is a weak leader. He's seen to be lacking in even basic executive ability. He's a very engaging fellow, personally quite honest. He lives modestly, rides a bicycle whenever possible. That appeals to the far left, and he's personally engaging, but he's not a strong figure. I don't consider Boris Johnson a heavyweight, but he's a very obviously successful, ruthless, tough politician, and Corbyn has not demonstrated those same essential qualities so far. So Labour is not doing all that well, although they are surging in the polls as we speak before the election. And that's another thing that makes this all so up in the air and uncertain.
So if Labour actually wins the election, even with a small majority—
Or a plurality, which would open things for negotiation with a third party. Excuse me.
I was going to say, that was my question. Would they become bedfellows with the SNP?
It's conceivable to me, because they're both left parties. The Liberal Democrats, who went into coalition disastrously with the Conservatives between 2010 and 2015, they've ruled out a coalition with either party. But in politics, especially when you have the rule of law, which frees up politicians to do all kinds of unpredicted things, it's possible that there'd be a coalition despite what politicians have said and virtually all parties.
What do you think will happen, no matter what, with the SNP? They're pushing for a second referendum on the Scottish independence vote.
Yes. My guess, as well as hope, is that the voters in Scotland would reject that, as they have in the past, though narrowly. I think the economic realities are such, and the military realities are such, that Scotland, a very, very interesting and very impressive region, population, society, There's still only about 5 million people there. Handling a totally separate currency relationship from London, which remains the financial capital of the world. Military obligations, including having to support major nuclear submarine facilities and other military facilities in Scotland. The realities are such would be tremendously costly for Scotland to be independent. So I think the people will pragmatically and empirically reject that.
Well, I was going to say the Scots are very much pro-European Union. They want to stay in the European Union. So that gets into Brexit and how much that's playing into this election.
Yeah, the reality of Scotland, in practical terms, again, is heavily integrated in terms of trade, all kinds of business collaboration, and finance with London, of course. They want to stay within the EU and want to stay, which is why, from my point of view, the best possible outcome would be for the British to muddle through and ultimately stay in the EU.
How likely is that?
I think it's possible.
Really?
I think it's less than 50%, sure, but it's possible. The good news is that the European Union and the predecessors, the European Economic Community in 57 and the European Coal and Steel Community a few years before that, they were put in place not for economic integration but to control the Germans and to prevent a third terrible war in Europe. And that has worked perfectly. Things are so good that the British can consider and actually leave the European Union and Europe would remain stable. I think it's good for Britain to be in the EU because they're a counterweight to the Germans and the French, who in different ways tend to dominate the continent today. Britain is also, more good news related to war, a committed member of NATO and a very important one. Very, very effective military power historically and currently, as you know. The British remain fully committed to NATO, and that's not going to change.
Moving a little further southeast, Benjamin Netanyahu recently was indicted in Israel. He is, how many terms has he served now as prime minister? He was in the 80s and then was kind of out for a while and then back.
Very durable.
Very durable, part of the Likud right-wing party. What does this indictment mean for Israel first, and then what does it mean for the Middle East?
It means for Israel that he's probably going to go down. There is lack of clarity about whether or not legally he can serve as prime minister under indictment. He, of course, says he can, but that's currently being considered by the judiciary. I believe the president of Israel will play a very strong role in the final resolution. He probably will not be able to put together a government, which means the Israelis will have yet another election soon. From my own biased opinion, I think he's been extremely destructive for lots of different reasons. It really is time for him to go. And so in that sense, the outcome would be desirable, including from the perspective of U.S. foreign policy.
Does the rest of the Middle East think that Israel is unstable at this point, that things are in flux?
Yes, domestically, but certainly not in terms of foreign policy. The Israelis of necessity have to maintain it extremely disciplined and extremely effective in terms of self-preservation, at least over the short-term foreign policy, and that continues. I do think that it means Israel is going to be less assertive, and insofar as Netanyahu's, from my point of view, very destructive promotion of ever-increasing settlements on the controversial West Bank is concerned, that's all to the good. If Israel's expansion can be stopped for a while, I think that would be extremely good for the Middle East and everybody else.
We mentioned protests at the beginning of our conversation, and there seem to be a lot of them happening right now. I'm just going to tick off a few, and then we'll talk about them. First of all, Iran. It's the worst unrest in 40 years. There's been a brutal crackdown on protesters. There are also, for the past month or so, big protests in Iraq, about 200,000 people from all over the country in any given day protesting in Baghdad. Hong Kong, ongoing protests against the Chinese government. Things happening in Chile, Bolivia, Colombia, in South America. What seems to be happening here? Are we just more aware of people objecting to what their governments are doing?
Yes, I think there's always been a lot of instability in the world, but thanks to pervasive media, especially television, and today the related electronic web media of all kinds, we're much more aware of it. Two analysts come to mind immediately, Sam Huntington a very, very, very influential person in policy and government terms as well as academic terms, a professor at Harvard, wrote several books that have had an important impact on life in general. In the 60s, he coined the term the demonstration effect, thanks to mass television, that the demonstrations and in many ways greater violence in this country, certainly in this country as well as others in the 60s, he said one demonstration touches off another, especially in terms of the student demonstrations of that time.
It's almost like people see it and think, well, we can do this too.
Yeah. The other important analyst is Richard Nixon, who wrote a whole series of books, and he devoted a lot of sustained attention to the Middle East and wrote about a decade in 1994, I think in the real war, about a decade before we invaded Iraq. It's very tempting to overthrow Saddam Hussein and also to try to overthrow the regime in Iran. But Saddam Hussein especially, keep in mind, fellow Americans, he's a stabilizing force. And if we overthrow him, give in to that temptation, the result will be chaos. And it won't be some kind of liberal democracy like some unrealistic Americans believe, even back then. It'll simply expand the influence of our most important enemy in the region, fundamentalist Iran. And he was absolutely right. So one lesson of all this instability is Americans should continue to be restrained, as we have been, I think, generally since the disastrous invasion of Iraq under George W. Bush. We should use diplomacy and carefully crafted disciplined policy to try to influence events there and elsewhere, as we are doing to a degree in Hong Kong. I'm very glad that President Trump signed the much-needed legislation to not only protest the ruthless and brutal crackdown of Beijing and Hong Kong, but also the president okayed very specific sanctions and leverage against China. That's where we can have tremendous and growing impact in this world.
So in the case of Iran and Iraq, the idea is to not go in with guns blazing.
Absolutely not. No.
What about South America? We don't talk about them very much. A lot of things happening there, too. You know, Chile had a bunch of protests, mostly economic-based,
yeah.
But, you know, Bolivia is really unstable right now. There are elections being promised, but nobody thinks they're going to be fair. Is that a knock-on effect from the other protests happening around the world?
Yes, to a degree. But Latin America has historically been characterized by a lot of populism, establishment of independent nation-states, in our terms, relatively early. And thanks to Simón Bolívar and associates in South America in the 1800s, but the stability that's characterized North America generally has never really characterized that region. So popular protests, that's nothing new. The U.S., starting with a New Deal, has generally been pretty restrained, again, about intervening militarily. Richard Nixon faced down demonstrators in South America, violent demonstrators in 1959, and really demonstrated the good neighbor policy, the American commitment to democracy and representative government in that very dramatic incident. That was back in 1959, more than half a century ago. There's nothing new about protests in Latin America. And overall, again, starting with FDR and the good neighbor policy, we have been wisely reluctant to directly intervene with military force, with some dramatic exceptions.
I was going to say we may not intervene with military force, but we have done a lot to put in people that we like covertly.
Of course.
Yeah.
Again, in recent years, I don't think that's the case. There are the automatic accusations that CIA is involved in any change of government. And I don't find persuasive evidence of that in recent years, including the current cases that you mentioned. Another good piece of news is back in the 1960s and 70s, during the height of the Cold War, outside of Costa Rica and one or two other countries, there were no democracies, even corrupt democracies that lasted in Latin America. And now, except for Cuba, ironically, they're all more or less representative governments. They have elections. In Bolivia, the chief of staff of the military urged the president to leave. But the tanks have not rolled into the capital in these
countries.
So
there has not been a coup yet.
Yeah, the old-time Latin American coups haven't occurred.
What do you think 2020 is going to bring us in world politics? Are we looking at more of the same that we had this year? Are some things going to resolve, do you think?
I think we're going to see more and more proactive and visible and effective leadership concerning climate change. It's extremely important. There's a conference going on right now in Madrid. It's an opportunity for the U.S. to exercise leadership, which we are not currently exercising under President Trump, although at the working level, dedicated career people in the U.S. government and others are working away on practical ways to limit this very serious and growing challenge. And I am quite sure that it's manageable.
Lake Effect contributor Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business, and he directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. You can listen to our past conversations with him at WUWM.com. After a break, we'll discuss a newly released study on the possible economic impact of Foxconn. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. A newly released study says instead of bringing a lot of money to Wisconsin, Foxconn, the Taiwan-based corporation that's building a manufacturing center in Racine County, could depress economic activity in the state by tens of billions of dollars over the next 15 years. The company is slated to earn economic subsidies from state government if it meets hiring and investment goals, but a study by a free market research center at George Mason University says subsidies don't work. WUWM's innovation reporter Chuck Kornbach asked the study's co-author Matthew Mitchell why his Virginia University was interested in the Wisconsin doings of Foxconn.
So there's a couple reasons. One, you know, I'm interested in what we call the economics of favoritism. Economists sometimes call it rent seeking, but it's basically private entities seeking privilege from government. And of course, targeted economic development incentives are rife with privilege seeking. And, you know, the specific case of Foxconn is interesting because it is such a large targeted economic development incentive. And we've seen these incentives grow in recent years about three times as a share of GDP. States and localities are giving out about three times as much in incentives now than they were in the 1990s. And we've seen a number of high-profile cases, Foxconn being among them. So it seemed like an interesting case to explore. And, you know, what it turns out is the way these subsidies are often sold really doesn't line up with economic understanding of the way subsidies actually work.
You've looked quite a bit at this concept of targeted versus general economic support. Can you sort of walk us through that, please?
Sure. So, you know, if you're thinking about, if you're a policymaker and you want to develop your economy, you are wise to recognize that any job or business or investment that's made in your state could have been made in another state. And of course, policymakers are keenly aware of this. They're in fierce competition with one another over jobs and capital and investment. And that's great. That's fine. But they have different ways of trying to compete for those economic factors. And so one strategy is to target particular firms or industries with special privilege. They'll cut a targeted tax privilege for those firms. They'll offer outright subsidies. Sometimes they'll do something in between, like a tax that is a refundable tax credit that amounts to a subsidy. But often policymakers seem to labor under the belief that this is the only way to attract business activity to their locations. But it's not. There is another method, which is to just make sure that your business environment is the best in which to do business, and also it's the best in which to live. So, you know, make sure the taxes are reasonable and non-discriminatory and relatively low, that regulations do what they need to do to keep the public safe but aren't overly burdensome. Make sure that genuine public goods are funded and that government doesn't spend too much money funding activities that aren't genuine public goods. So basically just make sure that it's the right environment in which to do business. And I would argue that there's a lot more evidence that that is an effective strategy for growth than targeted favors or privileges for particular firms or industries. The problem, of course, from a policymaker's perspective, is a general strategy does not allow them to stand in front of a particular factory and cut a ribbon or start digging the foundation with a golden shovel. So it's a little bit harder to claim credit for those types of things, but the evidence seems to suggest that they actually work better.
And there was quite a groundbreaking, including involving President Trump, then Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, for Foxconn in the Racine County community of Mount Pleasant, where a lot of the buildings are starting to go up. And I think we should remind folks about the size of the potential targeted investment for Foxconn. It's in the billions of dollars, isn't it?
That's right. It's potentially up to about $3.6 billion over the next 15 years. So this is orders of magnitude larger than any typical subsidy. I mean, literally hundreds of times, maybe even thousands of times larger than a lot of subsidies that states give out.
And you're arguing in your paper, you and your colleagues, are that the subsidy Foxconn may get may depress state economic activity in Wisconsin by tens of billions of dollars over the next 15 years. How do you reach that conclusion?
Yeah, so there's a couple of factors that are important. One is that we need to account for the fact that in most cases, subsidies do not seem to affect a business's location decision. There have been about 34 peer-reviewed academic studies of this, where economists have tried to assess the likelihood that a subsidy affected a location decision. And the best estimate is that subsidies are decisive in affecting location decisions somewhere between 2 and 25% of the time. So if Foxconn was going to invest in Wisconsin anyway, then the subsidy is a waste. If, on the other hand, it was decisive, then great, it was an investment that paid off. But we have no way of knowing. You know, Foxconn has an incentive to say that it was completely decisive. The policymakers who handed out the subsidy have an incentive to say it's completely decisive. But the best evidence is that these things are really only decisive in 2 to 25% of the time. So you need to discount the gross payoff from the subsidy based on that factor. And so when you do that, the benefits from the subsidy are much, much smaller. At the same time, the advocates of subsidies, if they sort of fail to mention this factor of the decisiveness, they also fail to mention any cost associated with subsidies. And as it turns out, you know, the $3.6 billion or up to $3.6 billion that the state will spend to subsidize Foxconn has to be drawn from the economy in the first place. And it would have done some benefit to the Wisconsin people if left in their pockets. They, too, would have been able to invest it, start their own businesses, purchase more products and services, all sorts of activities that would benefit the economy. So when you account, this is a well-studied phenomenon, the effect of taxation on economic activity. So when you account for that factor, there's a big gross cost. So really the net effect of the subsidy needs to take those two factors into account. And when you do, under realistic scenarios, this could cost the Wisconsin economy billions of dollars.
I think you even argue that if the Foxconn deal had not gone through, Wisconsin might have looked at things like cutting sales taxes, cutting business taxes as other ways to improve the economy.
Yeah, that's right. So just, you know, to put it in perspective, absent this subsidy for one firm, the state could have reduced its corporate income tax rate by about 22%. And that's a tax that's paid by some 16,000 firms in the state of Wisconsin. So you can imagine how much economic activity could have happened absent this privilege for one firm if the state had pursued a more general policy.
Well, reporters heard Governor Scott Walker say it probably a couple dozen times that if Foxconn doesn't come up with the jobs or the investment, then there isn't much of a way in a state subsidy. Does your study take that safeguard into account?
We do. And so the interesting thing is, so, you know, Foxconn originally was planning on building a large 10.5, they called it Generation 10.5 plant. That means that they were going to make large LCD displays. As it turns out, it's looking much more likely that they will build a Generation 6 plant, which makes smaller LCD displays. That means about one quarter of the investment, about one quarter of the local population hired. So it's a much smaller investment. And as it turns out, that actually is probably a good thing for the state of Wisconsin. So, you know, the irony here is a lot of people are characterizing it as, oh, that's so embarrassing for the state that Foxconn Foxconn sold them on a Generation 10.5 plant, but they're only building a Generation 6 plant. Actually, I think this is a blessing in disguise. It reduces the footprint of the subsidy quite a bit, and as a result, it reduces the amount of estimated economic loss for the state. So if they had built the Generation 10.5 plant, you know, there was a chance that they would have cost the state of Wisconsin somewhere between $10 and $20 billion over the next 15 years. Now it's a much lower range. It's somewhere between $1.2 and about $6 billion loss over the next 15 years. So actually, this is quite a blessing in disguise, in my view.
In the meantime, construction companies are at work in Mount Pleasant, trucking companies, roads have been rebuilt, money has been spent. Hasn't that brought some benefit, or are you saying that not as much benefit as other policies?
Yeah, so there's no question that when, you know, new economic activity is spurred, that's a benefit. Of course, that means that the folks who are building the roads and building the factory, they are getting an income, but then they're also turning around and spending some of that money elsewhere, and that benefits the economy. So there's no question, we call that a multiplier effect. There's no question that that is real and beneficial. The point, however, is that you can't just pretend that the money that funds that activity is like manna from heaven. It has to be drawn from the Wisconsin economy in the first place. And, you know, that money, if left in the pockets of Wisconsin taxpayers, they too would have gone out and spent or invested or done other things with that money, and that too would have created economic benefit. So you have to take account of the opportunity cost, that is, what else could have been done with that money. And then you also have to take account of the fact that in most cases, it seems like these investments would have been made anyway, whether they were subsidized or not.
I'm going to ask you to add a political scientist hat to your economist one.
Uh-huh.
We are within a year of the 2020 election, and Donald Trump has made the Foxconn property and project a big part of his efforts in Wisconsin. Do you expect this economic debate to continue as the presidential race continues here?
I do. And, you know, it's interesting. There is evidence that politicians benefit from handing out targeted subsidies. And the real reason appears to be not, you know, there's some benefit, of course, because the firms that receive them are able to essentially advertise for the policymakers. But I think probably the best evidence is that the public at large thinks that these things work. So I think economists have their work cut out for them in convincing folks that actually, you know, the best evidence suggests that these targeted economic development incentives really don't work, or at least not work as advertised. So that's, I suppose that's a little bit on me and my fellow economists. But there is, in my view, some evidence that the public is weary of this. I think Amazon's pullout from New York is evidence of this. I think you would probably be in a better position than I to know this, but I think the popularity of Foxconn in Wisconsin is waning a bit. Some of these really big, high-profile subsidies just haven't worked out quite as well as people thought they were. And, you know, I think the public has, there is a limit to their patience with these types of things. They only want to see them if they think that it's going to benefit the broader community, but they really don't love the idea of spending taxpayer money on, you know, wealthy and well-connected businesses.
I think the polling in Wisconsin showed the further away you were from Racine County, the less support you had for the Foxconn project. Does that sound about right then?
That sounds absolutely right. And, you know, that's a big part of it is you can do a cost-benefit analysis where you only look at the benefits of the subsidies to the community that receives them. And there's no question those communities are better off for the subsidy, but they aren't the ones who are paying for it on net, right? You know, the whole state is saddled with this, and there really is very little evidence that the broader communities that pay for subsidies benefit from them.
Still, you don't sound optimistic that subsidies are going away. Every state pretty much offers them, right? But you're saying do it in a smarter way.
Yeah, I mean, I would say don't do it in a targeted way. There's no reason to privilege particular firms or industries. That's not a road to prosperity. And economists really have known this for quite a long time. You know, essentially, the mercantilist system in the 17th and 18th century was rejected by economists for this very reason, that targeted benefits and privileges to particular firms or industries is not a path to prosperity. I would also add it's not really a very equitable policy. You know, those who benefit tend to be larger multinational companies that are relatively more profitable. Those who pay are, you know, general taxpayers who have higher burdens and have less prosperous economies as a result of this. But the political incentive to hand these out is pretty strong. So I do think they're going to be around until policymakers figure out a way to sort of mutually disarm in the subsidy war. I think there is a precedent being set right now. In Kansas City, the communities right around Kansas City on both the Missouri and Kansas side have agreed to mutually disarm in the subsidy war. I could see something like that on a grander scale actually solving this problem, where states formed, you know, interstate compacts or regional compacts where they agreed not to subsidize firms to relocate from one state to another.
We're not completely sure, but it looks like Foxconn will be around Wisconsin. Wisconsin's newer governor, Tony Evers, has said, listen, even if it's 1,000 jobs, Foxconn is welcome here. We support any new jobs here. Is that pretty much all the current governors can say when handed in something by their predecessors?
You know, I don't know the full legal scope that the governor has to try to reverse this. The subsidy actually was enacted through the legislature. So I think if he really wanted to try to eliminate the whole thing, he'd have to go back to the legislature and try to override it. And I doubt he has the patience or is willing to try to do that at this point. He's probably just pursuing what makes sense to him and politically.
Matthew Mitchell is an economist at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. He spoke with WUWM's Chuck Kornbach, and there's a link to the study at WUWM.com. After a break, the host of An Arm and a Leg podcast joins us to talk about the impact of healthcare costs in the U.S. Lake Effect returns with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. America's unusual approach to healthcare has been on full display in the lead-up to the 2020 election. Both Democrats and Republicans have relied on the hot-button issue as a consistent talking point, in part because it has such a huge impact on all American citizens. Healthcare costs here are prohibitively expensive, sometimes costing thousands of dollars just for a quick trip to the emergency room. Stories like these were part of the inspiration for the Arm and a Leg podcast, which showcases the horror stories and hard-fought victories of people dealing with America's healthcare system. The podcast is the brainchild of host and executive producer Dan Weissman, who spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in light of the podcast's third season premiere this month.
So you really started this podcast because you were facing this dilemma, which I think all of us who have those kinds of salaried jobs, we really fear losing great healthcare from your job and having to find new healthcare that still fits your needs. What was that experience like for you?
Absolutely terrifying. I mean, it was hugely terrifying. You know, I was ready to leave this job, and I wasn't ready to leave the health insurance. And my wife has her own business, and we didn't at that time think of it as something that would be a group insurance plan that we could take part in. So we were like, what are we gonna do? And especially because I live in Chicago, I live in a place where there the number of like employers that offer health insurance to folks who do the kind of thing that I do is limited. There's lots of work in making audio these days, but a lot of it's freelance. And the places where there are proper employers tend to be on the coasts. We are not interested in moving. So that was a big set of dilemmas. And I geared up for a few months to think like I might need a new career. What's it going to be? I really didn't want to. And in what was going to be the first week of a proper search for some brand new kind of job, I thought like, well, this was an idea that I'd had for a long time as a reporter, that this whole conversation about the insanity of how we pay for healthcare, I mean, one, lands a lot of people in enormous financial trouble that's quite serious and is terrible for people's health, but also that, like, it keeps people locked into jobs and kind of distorts people's careers, and otherwise just kind of like it permeates people's lives in all kinds of ways. And I didn't see a conversation about that. And I thought like there could be something there. I gave myself a week to talk to people about it. And it was really clear right away that it was worth putting another week in and another week in. And it was pretty clear within a month or two that this was a project worth doing.
It's funny, you know, I was just listening back to that first episode of your first season. And one of the stories that you highlighted was actually a woman who we both know, Nyla Boodoo.
Oh, yeah.
Nyla was diagnosed with breast cancer, something that actually both my mother and my sister had right when I started working with her at WBEZ. My mom and sister had just been diagnosed.
Oh, my gosh.
So she had her own issues with this.
She did. And Nyla was one of the folks that I called to say, like, hey, you're smart. You're a super successful public radio person and super smart journalist. What do you think about this idea? And she, you know, she had sharp questions about how the show might be. And she also shared, like, yeah, you know, I've just gotten wrapping up a year of treatment for breast cancer and I seem to be okay. But like, there's all kinds of unpleasant financial surprises. And I have great insurance. You know, the station where she works was a part of the state of Illinois. And she was like, I have the best insurance of anybody I know. And I'm getting all these bills by surprise at the end of the year. I'm being told, like, we thought you'd met your deductible, but there's all these things that turned out we have to charge you for. And it was, you know, as a friend and as a citizen, I was like, this is outrageous and horrible. And as a reporter, I was like, that's a good story. Can I talk to you about that on tape? She was one of several people who I talked to just to be like, hey, you're a person of the world. Like, what do you think about this crazy idea? And every single one of them was like, oh, well, here's my adventure.
Well, and that's kind of the crazy thing about the podcast. I don't think there's anybody who can listen to it and say, oh, this isn't relatable. I think everyone listens to it and goes, oh, I have 10 stories about this.
Yeah. I'm a hit at parties. People always come up to me with stuff.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, you've really been digging into this, but as you go into these stories, what are some of the recurring themes?
Such a good question. One that's been interesting is there's just a number of moms, of like heroic moms, who just dig in and do whatever needs to be done and really make impressive change. And I think that's, you know, I think that's probably true of anything that you dug into, but it's been very interesting here. But maybe here more than most, because in some cases, I mean, these are people who are fighting for their families, and that is a role that often falls to moms. Our season this year, our new season, the first episode is a woman named Stephanie Whittles Wax, whose daughter was born hearing impaired. And that's how Stephanie found out that hearing aids for kids cost $6,000 and only last for a few years. And in many states, including at the time, Texas, where she lives, insurance wouldn't cover them. And she undertook a campaign to get that changed. Her family's finances were not the main concern. They had gotten a grant to pay for her daughter's hearing aids, but she had a whole other story going on. Her brother had recently died of a drug overdose around the time her daughter turned one. And that was when she found that there was a campaign to change the law around insurance in Texas to make insurance cover hearing aids for kids. And she really needed someplace to put all that energy. And she really found it. And she pursued this for ultimately more than 2 years and won. So there are other stories like that in our episodes, but those are probably the top three. But like the presence of these like fierce, amazing women who are moms, you know, in order to address what's going on with their family, end up taking a role in history. That's one of my favorite themes that's come up.
Yeah, you know, the episode that you just mentioned, you titled, in fact, Mom versus Texas. And inside of that episode, you actually lay out kind of what the whole season is going to be about, and you describe it as self-defense. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, one of the things that I ended up thinking about, especially as we had completed two seasons, is that this is a long struggle, and the cavalry's not coming. We've kind of begun a presidential election, among other things, in this country. And the topic of like big changes to healthcare is a big one in some of those conversations. But none of that stuff's going to happen anytime soon. Even if your dream candidate were elected with their dream Congress and they passed your dream legislation, you know, in the first 100 days, that's a year and a half from now. And then tack on another couple years before anything takes effect. And it's become really clear, like, many of us, who knows, maybe most of us, are living in a kind of untenable situation. I mean, lots of people are really up against it and know it. But many of us are, for many of us, there's like a $3,000 expense or a multi-thousand-dollar expense kind of waiting around the corner if our kid trips and cuts his knee. and, you know, ends up in an ER because it's a weekend. That's the story I'm working on right now. Like, this stuff can happen to any of us at any time. And depending on how comfortable you are, or, you know, if you happen to have like absolutely gold-plated insurance, it might be not a huge deal to you personally. But there's lots of people for whom it's an enormous deal. And so the question is, like, what can we do? What can we do? And so, you know, Stephanie Whittle's wax is, you could say, kind of an extreme example. And I'm looking at some kind of extreme examples. These people are just like, I'm gonna make a big change. Our second episode is about a woman who's actually a neighbor of mine here who got in touch after she heard one of our episodes last year, who has type 1 diabetes and has never had a lot of money and has gone through periods with no insurance and has found a way to navigate the system and to not go broke, essentially. And it's taken a lot of work. So I'm very interested in the question of, like, what does it take to survive in this system? You know, and not every battle is winnable. And we're looking at kind of why and why not. There's a segment coming up called for Radio Week, I'm gonna call it, Can They Freaking Do That? You know, I get a lot of email from people of like, this happened to me. And I'm like, is that even legal? So we're finding out, like, what's actually legal, what's not legal. So, I mean, self-defense takes a lot of forms. Some of it are these kind of really extreme cases, and some of it is just like, what? Because there isn't, running down these first couple cases of can they freaking do that, it's not obvious, it's not easy. And I've been a reporter for a long time, and it's not always that straightforward. And if it's not your job to go find that stuff out, and, you know, you haven't been doing that job for a long time, it's very hard for most of us as consumers to get a bill that seems outrageous and ask ourselves, like, do I have any recourse here? Am I just out of luck? So we're finding out.
You know, episode 4 is out tomorrow. It's about the hidden costs of going to the ER, and it's pretty shocking just how opaque it was. Can you give us a bit of a preview of that?
Absolutely, yeah. This is a family in Denver, and their 7-year-old kid tripped in the backyard and split his knee open on some newly put in flagstones that had very sharp edges. And it was a Saturday morning. And this is a family that was, you know, on the lookout, trying to avoid unnecessary expenses. The first thing they did was they took a photo and they texted it to the kid's grandma, who's a doctor. And they were like, do we need to go see a doctor? And she was like, yes, that needs to be stitched up. It's pretty bad. And the next thing they did was they went to a local urgent care clinic because they didn't want to go to the emergency room. They knew that could be very expensive. And the doctor there was like, we could totally stitch this up, but I have to tell you I'm out of anesthetic. And so they were like, I guess we're going to the emergency room. And they got to the emergency room and asked, a guy with a laptop came in to take their insurance information once they'd been, you know, seated. And the mom, Sarah McSalka, said to him, well, how much is this going to cost? And he was like, I really don't know. And she pressed him. And eventually he was like, well, it really does cost like $600 just to walk in here. And she was like, ugh, but okay. It was awful, but she could see doing it. And she wasn't going to drive her kid back to the urgent care and have him bite down on a stick at that point. The anesthetic didn't actually work. The kid did scream a lot. And then a few weeks later, she got a bill from the doctor. She paid $200 after insurance, and she thought that was it. And then she got a bill from the hospital for $2,800. And it was just a one-line bill. It was like $2,800, pay up. And the statement from insurance was two lines. There was a charge for $1,400, we made it go away, and a charge for $4,200, we knocked it down to $2,800. And you have a high deductible, so you're going to pay it. And she called the hospital. She was like, is this a mistake? And the woman in billing was like, oh, no, it costs $4,200 just to walk in here. And that's the crux of it to me. The crux of that story is like, this is almost certainly what is called a facility fee, which the reporter Sarah Cliff, who now writes for the New York Times, and when she was at Vox, looked at thousands of ER bills, called a cover charge. You know, like walking into a bar where they get your money at the door. It's just a fee for showing up in the emergency room and being seen. And they range all over the place. And this almost certainly was one. And the crazy thing about this one was, you know, you want to know what your cost is going to be, your price is going to be a lot of times. It's reasonable in a way for a doctor or hospital to be like, I don't know. You know, I don't quite know what's wrong with you. I'm going to run an x-ray, but then I might have to do a CAT scan. I might have to do, who knows what I'm going to have to do? And who knows what I'm going to have to do to treat you? But this was not that case. This was a flat fee for just showing up. And the guy in the ER with the laptop knew that there was such a fee. He just was off by a factor of 7. And so we're looking at, like, how did that happen? How does that happen? Like, you can ask and you can get an answer and it's completely wrong. And what would it take for hospitals to do better?
You know, you have an episode about this in your first season, we're right at the end of open enrollment here. And something you talk about is, you know, we're all likely to pick out the wrong health insurance plan.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I talked with a super smart economist who did a study that actually proves, like, people tend to choose the wrong plans, and not just regular people. He gives quizzes to, like, economists when he goes and gives talks, and they often get it wrong. And the two big reasons are, we don't fully understand all the terms, and there's a lot of them, and they're not terms in daily life. I mean, you may know some or all of them, like deductible, out-of-pocket maximum, in-network, out-of-network. There's a bunch of things where you need to know exactly what they mean, because they determine what that math looks like for you to do. And then doing the math is complicated. And it's not just that you might have, you know, a deductible, which is the amount that you pay out-of-pocket before your insurance kicks in at all. You also have co-pays and co-insurance, and sometimes you have both. And that you might have a different deductible for being seen by the doctor than you do for being seen in a hospital, and a different one for getting pharmaceuticals, and a different one for the emergency room. And similarly, the mix of co-pays and co-insurance, which is a co-pay is like, you have a co-pay of $20 for being seen here today. And co-insurance is like, we're going to charge you 10% or 20% of our total charge, and your insurance takes care of the rest. But like, the mix of those things in a given circumstance for a given treatment can be unclear. It can be very different. So the math is really hard and it's really complicated. And it's impossible to get the right answer, because to get the right answer, you'd have to know exactly what all medical attention you might need in a given year. And obviously, you just don't know if you're going to, like, you know, blow your ACL out playing soccer next year, or, you know, God forbid, something worse. So it is honestly hard, and it's not, none of the standard tools that we're given give us any help. There are some states where the Obamacare exchange actually has a tool built in that can help you determine some of that if you know a little bit about what your health might be like in the next year. And some employers offer tools like this as a benefit. But the rest of us are really just, like, the best advice I've seen is to do a kind of 2 or 3 part calculation of, like, what does next year look like in a totally normal year where nothing bad happens? What does it look like in a year where I cut my knee and I need stitches and I end up in the ER? And what does it look like if I have some really serious medical condition or get hit by a bus or something like that? You can try to rough those things out and see and compare what different options you might have would mean for you. But it is, like, you want to open a beer or your beverage of choice and settle in for a while, because it's gonna take a while.
Dan Weissman is the host and executive producer of the Arm and a Leg podcast. It premiered its third season earlier this month. The fourth episode is out on Thursday, and it deals with the hidden costs of emergency room visits. Weissman spoke with Leg Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find more of our healthcare coverage at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then our Beats Me series answers your recycling questions. Leg Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Back with more of Lake Effect, I'm Bonnie North. For some people, recycling is a passion, but for others, it can be just confusing. In this week's installment of Beats Me, WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz works her way through some of the recycling questions you've been asking.
Our dive into the murky world of recycling starts with a listener's dilemma. For years, Laura Jackson carefully filled special plastic bags with her recyclables.
To bag up all of my recycling before putting it in the bin. I look back, I've been getting them on subscription from Amazon for 7 years. And my neighbors have been telling me for months that I'm crazy, because if you bag up anything and put it in the bin, it automatically gets thrown away. Like, that can't possibly be true.
It's true. Despite Laura's good intentions, filling or simply tossing plastic bags in your recycling bin is a big no-no.
Plastic bags are a big issue for us.
This is Samantha Longshore, Resource Recovery Manager for the City of Milwaukee. We're at its material recovery facility. That's recycling lingo for the place where stuff is sorted and baled.
We're moving about 35 tons per hour through this facility. Our quality control workers, they really don't have the time to rip it open, see what's in, dump it out. In addition, plastic bags do wrap around the equipment.
Plastic film and bags don't have to land in a landfill, though. Some grocery stores collect them, and in the case of Roundy's, passes them on to a company that manufactures plastic-based products. Deep breath now as Samantha takes on a few what can be recycled questions we've been gathering.
Paper envelopes with plastic windows.
With the plastic windows, it is a yes. That can go right in so you don't have to pull that plastic off.
What about cardboard containers with wax coating?
Like a carton, you're thinking. So cartons are in. Also juice boxes are in, but no straws. And then the caps can stay on the cartons, too.
The lid rule gets complicated, but as long as it's made of the same material, you should leave it screwed in place. Let's say the container is glass, but its lid plastic. In that case, remove and trash the lid, recycle the bottle only.
Okay, so what about styrofoam?
Styrofoam is a no. Styrofoam should not be put in your recycling cart. Another thing that our drivers do notice is that when you have cardboard boxes, make sure that you're emptying the cardboard box of the styrofoam and then flatten that cardboard box to help our drivers pick that up and save space in that truck too.
What about old mattresses?
Unfortunately, in Wisconsin, the only recycler we have is close to La Crosse. So not convenient for Milwaukee. So again, for that, you know, we just say please dispose responsibly.
There is a pickup service in the Milwaukee area called J-Dog that does recycle mattresses for a fee. On the lighter side, some listeners wondered about plastic tubes, like empty toothpaste tubes.
As much as you try to squeeze out the last of the toothpaste, there's probably going to be residue left in that, so that would be a knot in your recycling cart.
Can you toss and carry out pizza boxes?
If it has as grease or cheese or any kind of food residue, it shouldn't be recycled.
Samantha says people need to know not every municipal recycling program is created equal. Residents should check out their community guidelines. For instance, West Allis residents can recycle greasy pizza boxes, and its program accepts all plastics numbered 1 through 7. Milwaukee residents are restricted to those numbered 1, 2, and 5. What about listener Diane Buck, who's wondering about some old Teflon-coated cookware?
Pots and pans, skillets that need to be thrown out because they are scratched or damaged. Are they recyclable?
If she lived in the city of Milwaukee or West Allis, the answer is yes. But in the village of Shorewood, where Diane lives, no metal pans allowed in your recycling. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
You'll find additional recycling information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.